Genesis chapter 42 here this morning. We've been kind of working our way down through the life of Joseph most recently. And last time when we left off, Joseph has gotten a really good promotion. Boy, he went from swabbing the floors in a dungeon to being second in command in the most powerful nation on earth at that time. Wonder why that changed so greatly, I wonder. Well, chapter 41 told us in several different occasions, and God was with him, and God was with him, and God was with him. That's why Joseph's life has taken a turn for the better. And God is not only with him, but is working through Joseph to accomplish some things that he wanted to accomplish on behalf of his infant nation here. He used some dreams to communicate some things to Joseph, both earlier in his life when he was a teenager, and then most recently here as part of this promotion. Should we expect God to use dreams to communicate with us today? I don't think you ought to be looking for that. You got a book in your lap, I think, is where you get his revelation today. He can do whatever he wants to do. He doesn't ask us, right? But I don't think that's a normal pattern to expect. It was in this day, but I don't think it is today. So today he communicates with us through his word and through the Holy Spirit. Sometimes we get that little inner voice. We get that urge, that nudging that we can feel from the Holy Spirit. He communicates with us that way. But he's been using Joseph now to put into place some of the major building blocks for this infant nation to grow into a nation large enough to take care of itself. And he's put Joseph in a place, in particular in Egypt, in order to do that. He's been taking care of Egypt so Egypt can take care of Abraham's seed. And so he moves Joseph into place. Joseph will move the nation into place. It's small. It's a family more than a nation right now. And then it will grow into a nation down there in Egypt. And so we've seen God's common grace at work where he's blessing and taking care of Egypt, a bunch of godless heathens, so that they, the nation, Jacob and his family, can go down there and live in a more or less uncorrupted manner and grow into a much larger nation. So there's a couple outstanding issues that God needs to deal with here in regards to Abraham's seed to get them to grow into something much larger than it is. And he's using Joseph to do both of those things. One of them, of course, is to protect the nation. And that's what we've been watching unfold up to where we are now, to get this extended family to actually grow into a nation. And that's why Egypt will be the incubator for that. And the second major work that he needs to do on behalf of this family is the work of reconciliation. This family is not ready to be God's chosen people. It is not ready to be his representative to the world. This is a family that's characterized by dysfunctionality, to say the least. They're divided. They're suspicious. They're guilty. This family is a mess. There's a noticeable lack of spiritual leadership in this family on behalf of one of God's patriarchs. His chosen theocratic administrator is showing us very, very little. And the boys, even less. So there's some reconciliation needs to go on, and to get these guys in a position of being able to receive God's blessing. And God's going to use Joseph to do that too. And that's what we're going to see here in the next couple of chapters. The need for reconciliation in this family is going to be brought about through Joseph also. So he's serving as quite, well, you could almost say, maybe this would be true, that he's really more of a theocratic administrator than Jacob, his father. I don't think we're too far out of line to be thinking like that. So Joseph is really the one that's showing us something, and not Jacob. Now, when we left off last week, The dream that that Joseph had had about 7 years of something good happening and 7 years of something bad happening, that had started to take place. He's in place. The famine and the 7 good years ran their course, and then the famine set in and started making things bad on everybody, not only in Egypt, but in the surrounding areas. Verse 56 of chapter 41, when the famine was spread all over the face of the earth, then Joseph opened up all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. And all the people of the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in all the earth. And Joseph is standing at the crossroads of, he's like saving the earth, so to speak. He's like a teenage ninja turtle. He's saving the earth. People are coming to him to buy grain to eat from all over the place. And verse 1 of chapter 42, I suppose that people traveled through where Jacob was living, because Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt. And he said to his sons, why are you just sitting there staring at one another? I guess he saw these caravans coming through that area, and he kept asking people, well, what are you doing? They said, well, we're going down to Egypt. They got grain down there. We're going to go get something so we can survive. And so he says, look, there's grain down in Egypt. Why are you guys sitting here doing nothing? You know, none of them is taking any kind of a leadership role. So he said, behold, I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place so that we may live and not die. So let's us go get some too, boys. And so he rustles up his sons and said, go down there and get some. So verse 3, then 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. Wait a minute, now he's got 11 sons that he knows are still alive, right? One he thinks is dead. We know he's not, but he thinks he's dead. How come only 10 of them go down? Does the 11th one not need to eat? He or his family or anything? No, the explanation is in the next verse. Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, I'm afraid that harm may befall him. Sounds a little suspicious of the other boys, doesn't he? He says, I don't think I'm going to let my other favorite son go down there with you, because my first favorite son was hanging out with you guys and he's dead, so he thought. It looks like Jacob has some suspicions that his other sons may be responsible for the disappearance of Joseph. But he makes it clear he ain't about to let Benjamin, that would be his youngest, he's about 20 now, he ain't about to let him go down there with those other boys. So I think there's probably suspicion on the part of Jacob about the integrity of his sons, to say the least. So a caravan of 10 guys, load them up and move them out, going down to Egypt to get some grain. So the sons of Israel came to buy grain among those who were coming, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the ruler over the land, and he was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers then came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Now Joseph is an excellent administrator. He wants to know who's coming to buy grain from Egypt. And indeed, are they coming to buy grain? Are they coming to spy out the land to see where weaknesses might be? Are they probing Egypt? Are they truly coming to buy grain? So Joseph makes everybody come through him. He's a choke point on this grain, wisely enough. And so here come the 10 boys of Jacob down there, and they have to come and encounter him. And when they do, they bow down before him with their faces to the ground. Remember those dreams that Joseph had? His sheaves were in the field, and the other sheaves were bowing down to him. And then the sun and the moon, the stars all bowed down to him. They didn't like that dream at first, did they? What are they doing here now? They're fulfilling the dream, aren't they? They're on their knees in front of the guy. So those dreams are being fulfilled. Now, I wonder if during the intervening 20 years or so here, since he's been down there, Well, it wouldn't be during the 20, it would be more recent than that, because once he got in a position to know that people had to come to him, I wonder if he thought that maybe one day he would see his brothers. He might have thought this situation through a little bit before and thinking, you know, they may have to end up down here right in front of me like everybody else, because they got to eat too. If they do, if they come down here and I see them again, how am I going to play this? Am I going to be vindictive? Beat the daylights out of them? How am I going to play it? I don't know what their thinking is nowadays. I know what it used to be. They hated me. Do they still hate me? Would they hate my full brother, Benjamin, if he were here? Would they kill him if they had an opportunity out of vengeance and envy like they did me, or tried to? So he may have thought through some of these possibilities that we'll see him work out before they got there. I don't know. If he hasn't thought them through before, he's very good on his feet, because he's thinking how to do all this stuff on the fly. So here they are. They don't recognize him, verse 7 says. He disguised himself. Remember, he's clean shaven now. They're probably not. It's been about 20 years since they've seen him. He's grown from 17 to roughly 40. The 13 years in prison, 7 years of the good deal, and a year or two here, this going on. So he's, you know, he's about 40-ish now, and he was 17 when they saw him. So that baby face of his has changed into something else. They don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And his first action is to speak harshly to them and says, "Where have you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." But Joseph, of course, he'd recognize his brothers, although they didn't recognize him. So he kind of takes a hard line with them. Again, I don't know if he's being vindictive, if it's payback time, or what. His motives are a little hard to read here, and the commentators are kind of all over the place on it. Some think he is being vindictive and harsh to them on purpose, but he's never really all that harsh or hard against him. So if he's being vindictive, he could use some lessons on vengeance. He doesn't seem to be taking that much of that. But he does put on this front of speaking harshly to them and acting like he's suspicious of them. He's got the great advantage here now. Now, throughout this scene, there are a lot of parallels between Joseph and his actions and the brothers and their actions and God and his actions with sinful and lost men. Joseph's in the know. He knows what's going on. They're not. They're in the dark. They don't know what's going on. God knows about sinful man, and man does not know about him. So there's some parallels here to look for as we go through here. And the first one is that he speaks kind of harshly and makes them think that maybe something else is going on here than there is.
John, and, why wouldn't he be suspicious? I would be. After the way they treated him?
Well, he is suspicious of some things, as we'll see. The question I was raising is he being vindictive toward the guys? Is he going to try to punish them, get back at them for what they did to him? I think most people would probably understand that, too, if he did. But he definitely is suspicious of some things, and he's going to work out his plan here to clear that up. We'll see as we go along. Now, he remembers the dream when he sees them kneeling before him, but he questions their motives, whether he's befuddled or whether he's doing this by just knowing what he wants to accomplish here. He accuses them of being spies, verse 9. You've come to look out the undefended parts of the land. So he says to them, no, you guys didn't come down here to buy grain. You're a bunch of spies. And they say, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. Well, that assessment there could maybe be understood a little bit differently, couldn't it? Honest men? Now, they're probably not going to say to him, no, we're a bunch of murdering scumbags. So they use the other approach. No, hey, we're just a bunch of honest guys. We're just worker guys, you know. We just come down here to get some food. Now, he knows the difference, of course. But men can change, and so we'll see what he works out here. He says, no, you've come down here to look at the undefended parts of the land. But then they go on to try to explain a little further. They said, no, your servants are 12 brothers in all, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Normally, a spy team wouldn't send out 10 brothers. That ain't a good spy team. No, you mix them up a little bit there. You wouldn't do that. So they kind of try to justify their being there and said, no, look, guys, we're all family here. We're not spies. There was 12 of us originally. The son of one man, he lives up in Canaan. And behold, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. Benjamin is still at home, and they think Joseph is dead and gone. They don't know yet what the situation really is. It's interesting that over that 20 years that he's been down there, there's no attempt whatsoever made on their part to go try to find him, go back and try to undo or atone for their previous selling the guy into slavery. So they were contented for 20 years to blow him off. And did. So they think that there's only 11 of them left. So Joseph responds back to them, verse 14. Now, it is as you say, as I said to you, you are spies. I ain't buying that story, guys. You're a bunch of spies down here. And by this you will be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, and that makes it real serious for them, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Well, now that puts him between a rock and a hard place, doesn't it? What's he probing here? He's probing their attitude toward Benjamin, his full brother, the other half of the God likes us best duo. So he's trying to see if the brothers are going to treat his brother Benjamin the same way they treated him, out of envy, and do him some harm or something like that. So he wants to get Benjamin down there to see how they react to him, Benjamin. He knows how they reacted to him. The question is, are you still thinking like that? Are you still full of hatred and envy toward me and my brother? Much of which was prompted by the extreme favoritism displayed by Jacob. He caused much of this himself. So he says something to them that in essence makes them have to get Benjamin down there. He says, send one of you that he may get your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. But if not by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. So his plan is this. Again, if he hadn't thought this out, he's very good here on the fly. He says, one of you guys are going to go back and get that younger brother and bring him down here. That will verify the validity of what you're saying. The others will stay here in prison. Then I'll know that you aren't spies, and of course he will then know what their attitude toward Benjamin really is. So he puts them in a slammer there for 3 days. Now Joseph said to them on the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. Now Joseph, in essence, changes his mind, or they think he changes his mind on the third day, and he says, no, wait a minute, you don't all have to stay here. I'm going to change my mind and do something different here because I'm a God-fearing man, even though he's an Egyptian. Now, it wouldn't have totally blown their mind that an Egyptian could fear God and know something about their God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and so on. So that isn't terribly out of line, so they can accept that. He's a God-fearing guy. He says, if you're honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in prison, but as for the rest of you, go carry grain for the famine of your households. So he says, no, you need to get this grain back to your household, so I'll let you all go except for one. One of you must remain here as a hostage, but the rest of you can go ahead because I don't want your family starving to death while we're working this thing out. So they can go. And you bring your youngest brother to me so your words may be verified and you will not die. And they did so. So the plan changes from everybody staying and one guy going and getting Benjamin to one guy staying and all the rest of them going back to get Benjamin, so they can get that grain back where it needs to be. So then they said to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother. Now the first step of dealing with guilt is the acknowledgement of it, isn't it? They have now acknowledged, for 20 years they've kept us pretty well beaten down. But all of a sudden now they're starting to face the fact, they're looking at their circumstances and they're saying, man, you know, God is working us over here. We're guilty of what we did to Joseph because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us and yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. When he was pleading to us to get out of that cistern they put him in, a dry hole in the ground, we ignored him. We went off and had some ham sandwiches for lunch while he's down in that pit pleading for his life. And now God has put us in a situation where we're kind of pleading for our life. And they recognize the appropriateness of the circumstance, the distress, because of their guilt. That's a good step. That's a good first step toward reconciliation, is recognizing and accepting their guilt. So then Reuben steps up in verse 22 and he said to him, he laid a big I told you so on him. He said, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy? And you wouldn't listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. Now Joseph doesn't know that Reuben tried to intercede on his behalf earlier, remember? He was gone when the caravan came through and picked him up and took him on down to Egypt. He was going to come back later and get him out of the pit. He doesn't know that. For 20 years, he just assumed that all of them were perfectly happy throwing him in a hole in the ground. So he hears Reuben say that, and they don't know that he can understand their language. He's talking through an interpreter like he doesn't speak Arabic, but he understands now. Reuben tried to intercede on his behalf. Verse 23, they did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. And when he hears this, he turned away from them and wept. Brought him to tears to realize that at least he had one brother who tried to help him a little bit at least here, Reuben. And then when he returned to them and spoke to them, he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. So Simeon is going to be the designated hostage. He's going to let the others go, and he's going to keep Simeon in prison until they bring Benjamin back down to him. So got the scene in mind now? He's met them. They don't know that he knows them. He's put together this plan that is to try to give him a read on what their attitude is toward his brother Benjamin and see if that hatred that put him down there is still at work in their hearts. So this is the plan and this is how it's going to work out. One guy stays, the rest of them take grain and go home. So then Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey, and thus it was done for them. So they loaded their donkeys with grain and departed from there. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money, and behold, it was in the mouth of his sack. So they go back up toward Canaan. They get about a day's journey away, stop to feed the donkeys and stuff, and one of them opens his sack, and lo and behold, there's the money that was supposed to pay for that grain in his sack. So he says to his brothers, my money has been restored, and behold, it's even in my sack. Yikes. What's that look like? Looks like they stole the grain, doesn't it? Looks like they didn't pay for it. Their hearts sank, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? Now again, they see the hand of God in all of this, in retribution for their previous treatment of Joseph. They think God is getting even, and he's worked out a deal here that's going to get them hung. So they're dismayed. Now, what is interesting too here is that they don't turn around and go back to try to resolve this. They don't go back with the money and say, hey, we don't know how this happened, but the money's in our sack. Here, take it and walk away with the money. They go on home. Their brother is in prison down there in Egypt, and they go on home. So when they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan and told him all that had happened to them, the man, the lord of the land, spoke harshly with us, and they took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, hey, we're honest men. We're not spies. We're all 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father today in the land of Canaan. And the man, the lord of the land, said to us, by this I shall know that you're honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me and take grain for the famine of your households and go and bring your youngest brother to me, that I may know that you are not spies, but honest men. I'll give your brother to you and you may trade in the land. So they relate to Jacob the plan that Pharaoh's assistant, Joseph, set before them. That plan was that they had to go get their younger brother and take him back down there, and then he would release Simeon to them, and they could trade in the land and do whatever they wanted to do. Everything would be fine. So it came about as they were emptying their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were dismayed. All of a sudden, now it looks like nobody paid for his grain. All of these guys managed somehow to finagle the grain out of the Egyptians and not pay for it. Their story about all being honest men is getting harder and harder to sell. And here's their father Jacob's reaction. Great spiritual leader that he was at this time. Their father Jacob said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me. Now, poor old Jacob at this point in his life is about drowning in self-pity here. Everything is about him. This is God's chosen theocratic administrator. He has been given the promises of the Abrahamic covenant. He's going to have children that number as the sands on the seashore. And yet he's got a que sera, sera attitude here. Okay, if I lose my family and children, you know, so bit. But you ain't getting this one. You ain't taking Benjamin back down there. His life is totally anthropocentric, man-centered. It's about himself. It's not theocentric, about God and his plan and purposes. It's about me. Everything here has turned against me. Don't even mention the fact that Simeon is down there in jail. That's his problem, right? My problem is I got a problem. Jacob is not finishing well. He's not showing spiritual leadership at all in this family. So Reuben speaks up, and he's even worse as far as spiritual insight goes. He says to his father, saying, you may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back. Put him in my care and I'll return him to you. Now, isn't that a solution and a half? What consolation would it be to Jacob to kill his two grandsons if Reuben can't get his son back? What grandfather takes consolation in killing his own grandsons? The guy has got no sense whatsoever. Not to mention no spiritual insight. He doesn't even have any common sense. This is the oldest son, Reuben. It is a rash, illogical, irrational proposition if there ever was one. And by the way, notice he didn't say, you can kill me. You can kill my two sons if I don't get him back. Yeah, get those guys. And they're probably thinking, gee, thanks, Dad. Can you do anything else for us? I mean, this is just ridiculous. This is such an absence of spiritual insight and leadership and judgment that it's just phenomenal that God is going to make a nation out of this family. But Jacob says, my son is not going down there with you. For his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you're all taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow." I don't care about Simeon being down there. That's just too bad for him. You're not going to take Benjamin back down there and use him for trading stock or to get him out of there. I'm not going to turn him loose. What a mess. What a total and complete mess this family is. And this is a family that God is going to use to be offered to be, they failed in it, but he offered him to be a nation of priests. A collection of mediators between God and the rest of the lost world. This family was going to be that. It's going to grow into a nation, the nation Israel. And look at this mess. Only God could sort this out and make something out of this. They've screwed it up so bad that only he can fix it. And that's what he's in the process of doing here through Joseph. So, they basically blow off Simeon. They just say, forget him. Benjamin ain't going down there. Oh, Dad won't let us take him down, so, you know, what can we do about it? Let's just get on back to life. Nobody comes up with plan B, that maybe they could go down and take their money back and talk again and maybe explain something. Just forget the guy. Chapter 43, the famine was severe in the land, and it came about when they'd finished eating the grain, which they had bought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "Go back, buy us a little food." Well, they finally got hungry enough that they had to think again about Simeon and the circumstance he was in down there in Egypt. They needed to go back. They need to visit the grocery store again. So, nobody seemed to be concerned about him. It's just, we're starting to get hungry again. Let's go get some more. So Judah now speaks to Dad and says in verse 3, "Hey, remember, the man solemnly warned us, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.' If you send our brother with us," that is Benjamin, "we'll go down and buy you food. But if you do not send him, we're not going down there. For the man said, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.'" So Judah steps forward and says, hey, Dad, we ain't going down there if you don't let Benjamin go with us. We know what to expect if that's the case. And we ain't going. So Israel, and by the way, now, Jacob's name is used more, his name is changed to Israel, and it's used more often as Israel now in the storyline from here going forward. So if you see that name, Israel or Jacob, same guy. Okay, same person, just different name. So Israel says to him, "Well, why did you treat me so badly by telling the man whether you still had another brother?" Again, it's all about him, not them. And they said, "Well, the man questioned us particularly about us and our relatives, saying, 'Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' So we answered his questions. Could we possibly know that he would say, 'Bring your brother down?'" So they explain how this has all come about. They didn't know when Joseph started questioning them that he was setting this trap for them to get Benjamin down there. They're just trying to answer his questions, which was reasonable. So Judah then says in verse 8 to his father Israel, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, as well as you and our little ones, and I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, let me bear the blame before you forever." So Judah, unlike his older brother Reuben, offers himself as surety for Benjamin, not his sons. And he says, "You can blame me and hold me accountable for the rest of your life. You can cut me out of your will. You can not come to my house for Thanksgiving or whatever." But it's himself that he offers up, not his sons. He is at least more noble than Benjamin. said, if we had not delayed, surely we could have returned twice. He said, if we had just ignored Simeon down there and let us go on back right away with Benjamin like we asked, we could have been down there back a couple of times by now. So Jacob finally relents in verse 11. He says, well, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best products of the land in your bags and carry down to the man as a present a little balm and a little honey, some aromatic gum and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. The best they got, whatever they got, take him something as a gift. And take double the money in your hand. Take it back in your hand, the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was a mistake. This guy doesn't understand the concept of divine providence at all, does he? Maybe it was a mistake that money got put back in each one of your bags. Come on, Jacob. Wake up here, pal. And take your brother also, arise and return to the man. Okay, take Benjamin with you. And may God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of the man that he may release to you your other brother. Let's see, what was his name? Simeon, yeah. Get him and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. How many times had God told him that the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant were transferred to him, Jacob? And that part of those provisions was a seed, a line of descent that would be huge in number. How can he think he's going to lose all of his children with that promise? This is a guy that wrestled with God before until he got God's blessing. Now he doesn't seem to actually remember anything about it at all. He isn't going to be bereaved of his children. That can't happen. 28:14, he's going to have children that are innumerable. But he doesn't even remember that, apparently. So they put the present together, took double the money in their hand, and Benjamin. Then they arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. And Reuben's two sons were probably cheering them on as they left town, saying, good grief, thank you that I don't have to go down there, or something. So Jacob has to relent. Joseph's plan is working out well here. If he hadn't thought that out before, he did really good on his feet on the fly. He's got the right plan in place. And this is getting Benjamin brought down there to him so he can observe what's going on. So when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, they get down there, he said to his house steward, bring the men into the house, slay an animal, and make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon. Well, that's unusual, isn't it? Egyptians don't eat with Hebrews. It's ironic that the Hebrews think the Gentiles are dogs, while the Egyptians think the Hebrews are dogs. They're not going to share a meal anywhere. But Joseph has invited these guys into his house. And they were afraid, verse 18. Because they were brought to Joseph's house. And they said, well, it's because of the money that was returned in our sacks the first time that we were being brought in, that he may seek occasion against us and fall on us and take us for slaves with our donkeys. They're expecting the worst. They think Joseph has them brought into his house so he can nail them. Guilt typically leads to fear, doesn't it? These guys know they're guilty. They're fearful of what's going to happen. But those are the things that are necessary in order to bring about reconciliation. Recognizing one's guilt, fearing the consequences of one's guilt. Remember, Joseph's in the place of God. They're in the place of the lost man. Knowing that you're guilty before God and fearing the punishment from God, that's a good first step toward reconciliation with God, accepting his provision for your guilt, someone that pays for it for you. So the roles here are very analogous to the working of God in the lives of sinful men. So they came near to Joseph's house steward and spoke to him at the entrance of the house. And they said, hey, guy, let me explain to you what happened here. We came down to buy food the first time, and it came about when we came to the lodging place that we opened our sacks, and behold, each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, and our money in full. So we brought it back in our hand. And we've also brought down other money in our hand to buy food. We don't know how our money got in our sacks. Now, if we didn't know what was going on here, you'd never believe that story, would you? That 10 out of 10 guys had their money in their sacks? No, there's something wrong here, they think. But the steward is the one that did it. Verse 23, he said, "Be at ease, do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given your treasure in your sacks. I had your money." So the steward now refers to their God. Where would this Egyptian learn about their God? About their brother, Joseph? Yeah, I suspect Joseph taught this guy something about the true God, and he recognized it, and he recognized what was going on here, that God was doing some kind of a work. He probably didn't know a whole lot more about it, but he knew God was doing something there. And he explains to him, "Relax, guys, I had your money." And then he goes and gets Simeon out of jail then and brings him to them. So he brings them into Joseph's house, and he gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys fodder. So they prepared the present for Joseph's coming at noon, and they had heard that they were to eat a meal there. So they're aware that they're going to eat a meal with him. And so they get their present ready to give it to Joseph when he shows up, and they're there at his house. So when Joseph came home, probably works pretty close to the house there, they brought into the house to him the present which was in their hand, and they bowed to the ground before him. Again, remember the dreams? Then he asked them about their welfare, and he said, "Is your old father well of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" And they said, "Yeah, your servant, our father, is well. He's still alive." And they bowed down again. And he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. Now, he was probably about three when Joseph got hauled down to Egypt by the caravan. And it's been another 17 years. So, a little more than that, probably. So, you know, last time he saw him, he was just a kid, just a youngster, a toddler. And so this is the first time he's really seeing his full-blooded brother, Benjamin. And when he sees him, he says, "May God be gracious to you, my son." It kind of speaks to him like he's older than he really is, that much older than Benjamin really is. He wasn't that much older, but acts like he's old enough to be his father, which he really wasn't. And Joseph hurried out, for he was deeply stirred over his brother, and he sought a place to weep and entered his chamber and wept there. So again, he's brought to tears by all of this again. He doesn't want them to see him weeping over these particular circumstances. They kind of let the cat out of the bag. So he dismisses himself somewhere and has a good cry over what he's seeing here. Cleans himself up in verse 31. Comes back into the room and says, "Serve the meal." So they serve them by himself, that is Pharaoh, or excuse me, Joseph by himself, and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves. They don't sit at the same table, not the Egyptians and the Hebrews. See, that's why Egypt is the perfect place for this nation to grow into adulthood. The Canaanites would have intermarried with them and absorbed them. The Egyptians don't want them even eating at the same table with them. So you can live here in Egypt, but stay away from me, the Egyptian. So that's the perfect place, and God put them there. Where else could he have sent them? What other nation could have protected them until they grew into a nation themselves, and yet did not want to intermarry with them and absorb them and corrupt them? Where else could they have gone? Nowhere else. That's why Joseph was taken captive in Egypt, is to lay the groundwork for getting the people down to Egypt. So everybody gets something to eat, but at different tables. That was loathsome to the Egyptians, verse 32 says. So they were seated then before him. And check this out. The firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. So at the table, they line these guys up, Reuben down to Benjamin, oldest to youngest. What's the chances of that happening coincidentally? 1 in 40 million that you could take 11 guys. It's basically 11 times 10 times 9 times 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 2. That's the odds. One in that number. It's close to 40 million. It's 39 million plus. That's the chances of that happening by chance. And they look at that in astonishment, verse 33. They think, wait a minute here, Hoss. How in the world did that just happen? They're scratching their heads real hard, probably. So then, Joseph, keep trying to give him a promotion here beyond what he's already got. He took portions to them from his own table. Now, it would be a courtesy for Joseph then to take from his table, which is where all the best stuff is, and take it to each one of the other people that are eating there with him. So he does that, but he gives Benjamin 5 times as much as the other guys. Now, what he has seen before, how do you think he would have expected the brothers to react to them getting 5 times more than they got from the best of Joseph's table? Take him out and throw him in a pit somewhere? That's what he's trying to find out. Do they still respond to the favoritism that he received like they did before? Are they going to now dump on Benjamin because he is receiving favoritism? Is their animosity now that was displayed toward him before going to be directed at Benjamin? He now is getting the goodies over them. But they feasted and drank freely with him. They didn't have a problem. If they all start saying to Benjamin, "Benjamin, you little rat, how did you get that privilege? Give me some of what you got." No, they didn't have a problem with it. They had a problem with it 20 years ago. But they're recognizing, apparently, their guilt and they're handling it okay now. That animosity between the various brothers, especially the half-brothers to Joseph and his full brother, Benjamin, isn't there anymore. That's what he wanted to see. He was suspicious of that. That's why he wanted Benjamin down there, so he could himself see their reaction to a favoritism directed now toward him, Benjamin. And when he did that, He got the response that he really was hoping for, I think. And they're tolerating it just fine. So, they don't know yet the end of the story. He hasn't revealed himself yet. We'll get to that next week. But things are looking better, aren't they? They came back with the younger brother. He doesn't appear to be the object of their hatred, as Joseph himself was earlier. And maybe there's hope for this family after all. Maybe they can stop hating one another long enough to get along and function together as God's people. And indeed, that's the reconciliation that we are all hopeful for here and looking for in this circumstance. So we'll continue the storyline next week. Things are looking up. Joseph is either well thought out in his thinking or he's thinking very well on his feet. He's got a plan in place that's giving him the answers he needs to get from his brothers. They're displaying a much better character than they had before. Their father is displaying a big bunch of nothing. But they're doing better. So we can end the lesson on a high note, a hopeful note. And we'll see it unfold next week when we continue on. Any questions or comments about anything we've seen in this part of the lesson? major building blocks being put together by God to get the nation in a safe place and to get reconciliation within the family so he can build on it. Yeah, Bill?
I was a little confused in verse 23. It says, then the steward said, may you be well. Who would that steward be?
Steward is a manager of a household. He's the head slave, head servant. Typically, a butler maybe would be analogous. Typically, they had the key around their neck to the household possessions, the storehouse, the food stores, and all that sort of stuff. And he would manage the household for the head guy. Beg your pardon?
Like Joseph was to Potiphar.
That's right. Joseph was the same thing to Potiphar. He ran Potiphar's house. Potiphar didn't pay attention to anything except what he ate. This steward is doing the same thing for Joseph. He would be the most authoritative individual in Joseph's family, in his household. And he apparently, perhaps is a God-fearing man himself now. He doesn't say, my God, but he refers to their God and the God of their fathers, but he understands how God works. So, you know, maybe Joseph won him to faith. I don't know. Possibly. We can hope. Yeah, Peggy.
I wake up this morning kind of thick, and I got to thinking about, was Canaan the promised land or not?
Was who?
Canaan, the promised land.
Yes.
And I had to look it up. I hate to admit that. But what occurred to me was, God told them to go into Canaan and to wipe them all out, and they didn't. But he still rescued them out of there.
Yeah.
And took them to Egypt. And I never
thought... Well, no, he didn't tell them to wipe them out before he went down to Egypt. It was
no,
after.
But then, when they went into the promised land, he told them to clear out the Hittites and the Canaanites.
Well, that's right. Under Joshua, they were supposed to go in and take over the whole place.
Yeah, and they didn't. So their unbelief and rebellion, he still rescued them out of that and took them to Egypt, out of that land he promised, even though they didn't fulfill what he told them to do.
Well,
he
took them to some place, but not Egypt again. After they went in under Joshua and tried to take the land and failed, and you went through the period of the divided kingdoms and all that stuff, the Assyrians took the northern 10 tribes captive in 720 B.C.
But that's after.
That's right.
After they went from Canaan to Egypt is what I'm talking about.
No, Canaan to Egypt was 430 years before Joshua. What we're seeing right here now is they went down there to grow from 70 people into 2 million. They come out and they go up and they start trying to take the land and they fail. And they mill around in there for quite some time until God leads them all captive by other nations, one the Assyrians and one the Babylonians.
So there were two times in Canaan.
Well, they were in and out of the promised land from the time that Jacob came back to on down to today, really. I mean, if you want to carry it on that far down. That's all right. We'll talk through this history. It's not all straightforward and necessarily easy to keep in mind. So they got to get from this little handful of people into a 2 million person nation before they can go take the land. So he got them out of Canaan so they couldn't be corrupted. Now they can grow into their own nation, and they can go back later, 430 years later, and try to take that land by force. And they didn't do a real good job of that. Didn't do a terrible job, but not a real good job. They got some of it, but not all of it. And so they started intermarrying and all that kind of stuff, and it got so bad that he finally judged them through captivities by foreign nations, the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Then it came back in there again during the Intertestament period, and then the Romans came in there and kicked them out again.
I think I'm going to have to keep coming.
Well, if you're thinking about not, I'll try to confuse you further, and then maybe you'll come back then. Okay, any other questions or comments about what we've seen? Okay, we'll let you roll. You all have a good week. See you next Thursday. Try to behave yourselves.